You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. The COVID-19 pandemic has been hard on everyone. But imagine if you were living in poverty, a migrant, someone with no way to socially isolate. What if you were a woman working in the sex trade? What if you were a domestic worker, a caregiver? How has the pandemic and the lockdowns impacted the most marginalized among us? And how have exploitative industries profited? How have women, in particular, been impacted? And how could we better support these women? This week, I talked to Anna Zobnina, a member of the Executive Committee of European Women's Lobby, a former research analyst with Mediterranean Institute of Gender Studies, a selected expert with European Institute for Gender Equality, and a board member of the European Network of Migrant Women, a young migrant woman-led platform of NGOs that works in the spirit of intersectional feminism for the rights of migrant women in Europe. Her article, Global Feminist Perspective on the Pandemic, What Normal Do We Expect When the Crisis is Over, can be found at migrantwomennetwork.org. Here's that interview. To start, I think it's really important that you've brought up a global perspective, because in many places, particularly in the West, you know, if we're living in Canada or the US, even the UK in many places, I think we forget about the reality that so many people around the world are facing and living in. So, you know, you wrote about how at the onset of the eruption of this pandemic, the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control published a set of measures to help fight COVID-19. Can you talk a bit about what you feel these measures failed to account for?
Well, I think they failed to account for a lot of things from the perspective of women and girls, but also other groups, including the elderly, including, as we know now very well, like people in the elderly homes. But we specifically looked at this document from the perspective of how such measures can be implemented in the refugee facilities. So we have different types of facilities around Europe. Some of them are literally like prisons where people, I'm speaking about women, but a lot of the times they're mixed with men. There's no real separation. There are no safe spaces for women. Sometimes some camps are only for women, but it's a rare thing. Sometimes they're more like prisons, sometimes they're more like open centers and people are allowed to leave and come back. But the thing is that they're in overwhelming majority are overcrowded. It's impossible to maintain what they call the social distancing. And very importantly, there is no access to clean water. There is not enough clean water in the camp. And I don't even mention like hand sanitizers. Of course, there are some NGOs. There are some people who are doing good work on the ground, and they come in and they distribute what they can, from food to, diapers for mothers who have little babies, but it's not enough. And what happened is that this is completely overlooked in those measures, and this is what we learned by speaking with our members, that in a lot of migrant communities, this includes those who are accommodated, like the refugees in the camps, but also what they call the migrant ghettos, basically. There was no information, there was not enough reach out. So it's still the case that in some camps, women, I speak about women because that's our target group, but I presume it will also apply to men, they do not know what it means to take these measures for social distancing, what it means to be quarantined, what do you do if you have some symptoms. So yeah, this was a generic measure, and it's really just one example of how a lot of the measures that the European Union produced were what we call gender blind, blind to women, for example, or women in the refugee camps. Yeah, and that's just one aspect.
Right. And so what would you recommend be done differently, or what are some of the things that could have been done differently to better address, you know, these realities?
Okay, if we speak about the camps where there is a large concentration of refugees, so we have Greece, for instance. In Greece, there are islands. These are the kind of the first entry points where a lot of refugees arrive, and then obviously they try to move from there into mainland Europe. And our recommendation, demand really, not just our, but with a lot of NGOs, is those islands, they were supposed to be, they were supposed to evacuate all the people from those islands, because it's not possible to create any of the conditions that we need now to prevent the spread of the virus in those islands. So this is like an extreme situation. And then we have certain camps where normally they should be shut down as well, and people have to be accommodated into flats, in hotels, but somewhere where this social distancing can be maintained and where they have access, like, to clean water, for example. In other cases, and this is what we hear happening, you know, there are detention centers where they apparently are releasing refugees. But in our question is, what happens next? Like, where do they release them? Where do they go? Do they have secured accommodation? Where do women end up, and like mothers with their little children? We don't know anything about it. So it's also a question, okay, we demand to release the people from what is effectively a prison-like environment, but at the same time, there should be a follow-up. What happens with these people, where they accommodate them, and what kind of access to which services they have.
Right. And I wonder, you know, we know, as feminists, that the caregiver role usually falls on women. So I wonder, how are the lives of women, but marginalized women in particular, you know, women in these refugee camps, poor women, et cetera, impacted by these kinds of pandemics?
Well, the carers, I can speak from the perspective where we are in Europe, but I think it will be pretty universal, with an exception that in Europe, women in such positions who do the care work or cleaning or domestic work, they might have a little bit more protection in comparison, for example, with domestic workers in Lebanon. But the pattern is that, okay, there are women, first of all, who, despite all of this quarantine measures and lockdowns and kind of most of us having to stay at home or working from home, like myself, I'm able to do it. Those women, they continue working. So they're the key workers, they're essential workers. They go to hospitals. A lot of the women that our members are serving, those women work in small grocery stores, or they work in big supermarkets. A lot of them are in domestic work. So what happened that some of them, they just continue working under the same conditions and without sufficient protection. And for other women, they completely lost their work, like domestic workers. And we have really tragic cases. So, for example, we were contacted by one of our members who's from Moldavia, and she told us that the government of Moldova installed a restriction to kind of prevent the citizens of Moldova from returning back home. What they did, they asked everybody to purchase quite expensive health insurance, And there were a lot of Moldovan women, and a lot of them are concentrated in domestic work. Some of them are undocumented. Some of them are documented, but they're without proper contracts, so they won't be compensated by the state. And they were trying to go back home, and they were prevented from boarding the plane because they didn't have this insurance. And then they ended up in the street, and then they didn't know where to go. There were no services. They wouldn't go to shelters because they're not seeing themselves like as victims of violence, or they're not seeing themselves as homeless persons as such. So it just created a lot of, it's very contextual. It would depend on the country. It would depend on the group of women and which employment category they are. And the impact is, it can vary. But those women who are concentrated in the care sector, domestic work, cleaning, nursing homes, of course, like elderly homes, they will be under severe strain. This is what we know from speaking with our members. Like, you know, for example, a lot of our members are service providers. So they receive women in their offices normally on a daily basis. And what happened is that now they shifted online. And of course, there is only so much you can do online as a service provider. But what we observe is that those women who would use their services regularly before, now they are under such stress. Even the speaking about violence at home or some kind of problems when you don't even have a personal space. So women in the refugee camps, to speak to some service providers who are trying to help them, they have to go and lock themselves in the toilet because there is no other space where they have privacy, where they can have a conversation like this. You know, it's just one detail, and there are a lot of stories like this. And then we have like women who are undocumented, and this is, a lot of them are domestic workers, like in Spain. And for example, the government of Portugal, they were very fast in reacting to the situation. And one of the measures that they took was to process all the pending applications that migrants or refugees had. So they didn't regularize everyone who was undocumented, but they gave the status for which people applied before within like 3 days. And all of those people entered into protection, whether it's financial protection or whether it's health. So they became protected by the state. And then they also, what they did for undocumented, if they didn't apply, they didn't have pending application, but at least they guaranteed that if you're undocumented, you would still have the same access to health services as any other person. But this is an exceptional measure taken by Portugal, and most states didn't do anything like this. In Italy, for example, in Italy, there is access already to anyone, even if you're undocumented, you have access to public health services. But the problem is that a lot of migrant women and a lot of women who are working in care and domestic work, they do not know about it. So there's this big issue with informing women about their rights. And under the current conditions of the lockdown, it became almost impossible because you cannot find those women, you cannot reach those women.
I was glad that you talked about the troubling nature of statements we hear so often, or have heard so often throughout this whole thing, like it's only the elderly who are at most risk. Just for those over 70, the fatal outcome is high. So many died, but most of them were old. Those kinds of things. Can you tell me what it was that troubled you about those repeated statements?
Well, the first one, you hear it, we don't ordinarily refer to people dying like, you know, it's okay, they died, but. It's not very usual thing, but then it just occurred to us when it was repeated in media so many times, and then it became clear how normalized it is that we live in a society that kind of despises old people. And then from old people, we move, of course, to old women. And then, like, from a feminist perspective, we have a very clear understanding that elderly women are erased. They are erased from media. They are, you know, vilified. There is this glamorization culture of, you know, youth, which is promoted through various media. But I mean, it's everywhere. We know this. And then it was just emphasized. And all of these discussions about the elderly people dying and the reactions, also the state reactions. Actually, we were discussing it today. You know, in Sweden, for example, which is a very progressive country in many ways, not only in terms of women's rights, but like social policies and protections. At least we would like to think about Sweden in this way. But the way they are dealing with this lockdown. I mean, they decided not to do the lockdown, so people are still in the streets. Everything is working, not in the same way how it would be under normal circumstances. But people are dying in Sweden, and there are, I don't know exactly, about 2,500 deaths right now. And they, most of them we know, are in care homes, and it's elderly persons. And then we were discussing with some of our members who are in the neighboring Nordic countries who took a very different approach. So, for example, Finland, they went into lockdown very early, and the rest days is much slower there. And we compared these two approaches, and it is apparent that in the Swedish case, what they prioritized is the economy. So, and whom they basically threw under the bus are those people who are the most affected by coronavirus, and they are the people in the care homes. And this is very disheartening, I think, when it comes from a state like Sweden, because we look at Sweden as this beacon of social progress and who sets the standards for social policies, including the feminist foreign policy. And then all of a sudden, they take an approach to handling this crisis almost the same that you would expect from a country like Netherlands, who is quite known, I think, for their very pragmatic attitude to solving problems. Like, you know, you can't eliminate prostitution, let's just regularize it and that's it. And yeah, it's, I think it shows a lot where we stand in terms of as a European community as a whole. And also it reflects, in a sense, how European Union has reacted to it, and the reaction was very late. And I think it's very, very worrying. But it definitely showed the social attitudes and very patriarchal attitudes towards elderly people. It's a disrespect towards the elderly persons, and we know who would be most despised in this category. It will be women, of course. Like, you know, it's bad enough that all elderly people are looked at as a kind of disposable category, but we know that the most disposable inside it will be women.
Exactly. I've read quite a bit in terms of reports on the dangers for women around the lockdowns with regard to women who are in abusive relationships, for example. So I wonder if you can talk about what the connection is between these kinds of pandemics and this particular situation with the lockdowns and the quarantines and male violence. You know, what's happening in terms of male violence against women right now globally?
Yeah, well, there are so many things that can be said about it. One basic starting point that, and we mentioned this in the article, and I think it should be apparent to anyone because we have statistical proof for it, is that our homes for women, as long as we're living and sharing space with men, is the most dangerous place for us to be. And we know that women are getting killed and raped and battered at home most. So if you look at the statistics of homicide from 100 people killed at home by men, 80% will be women. So obviously, anything, any measure that says that we have to stay at home, it should be immediately, it should raise an alarm that this can lead to the increase in domestic violence, including femicide. And this is the pattern that we have seen in many countries, but there is also something strange happening right now. And I personally am not ready to comment on this, in the sense I cannot explain, I can't find a causation for this, because we also see a drop in reporting. We heard it from our partners in Italy, we heard it from our partners in Portugal, we heard it from our partners in Finland, and from some services. So sometimes it's the whole country, but sometimes there are just some service providers who say that there is a drop in reporting. Women report less violence. And we know that we can't jump from the conclusion that, oh, there is a coronavirus and women are at home with men, therefore men became less violent. And this definitely can't be the case. So there is something going on, and we still cannot explain what it is, but there are these two kind of different patterns. There is, on the one hand, there is a definite increase. There was spikes in reporting of violence and women trying to leave home and find shelter, and the shelters were overcrowded. Of course, there was also some shelters were shutting down, and this was another reason why there was not enough capacity to accommodate all the women. We know this is just from Europe, and then we have countries like South Africa, where there was, I don't know how many, 90,000 cases reported. There was a sharp increase, and in some of those countries, we need to remember that there are no ways for women to report. There are no mechanisms for them to report, or maybe they don't have a phone line, or they don't have access to internet. It's or maybe it's only in some areas. I mean, they don't even cover the rural areas. So it's definitely a big problem, but this just concerns male violence, intimate partner violence, like in the household, at home. But then there are other aspects that we think that we need to think about, even if it is not happening yet. But we know that this is a huge crisis of global proportions. We know that any kind of crisis where there is a disruption to social structure, to income, to employment, and a lot of psychological pressure as well, we know how men generally, and it's not an overstatement to say this, we know how men react to situations like this. We know that generally speaking, men as a group of humans, they deal with a crisis like this in a way that as to express their frustration on other people. And very often, if not most often, the first people in their proximity are women. So we fear that maybe it will not be immediate, but, you know, everybody speaks about economic crisis, of course, but whenever there is an economic crisis and a social crisis, there is also a crisis of masculinity, of how they are dealing with this crisis. And we know that as a society, we're not prepared for this. So, you know, in the beginning of lockdown, in Italy, when in most of other countries in Europe, people were still going out and they were taking it quite lightly. But we were speaking with our members in Italy who were already like getting close to 1 month of lockdown. And they were saying, well, we just expect, I mean, you know, small examples, like a guy walks in the pharmacy and then he loses his temper because he needs to do the social distancing and he can't take it. And then he just smashes the shelves and runs away. Or a guy walks in a supermarket and starts spitting on vegetables to express his whatever it is, psychosis. So it's like small things like this. And then women, I was speaking with our members, and they were saying, like, they were observing those little details, and we are trained to see this pattern of male violence. And it becomes quite scary. So they were saying, well, what do we expect next? Those guys are just going to go in the street and start setting cars on fire and smashing windows. I mean, this is not entirely unexpected. And then, like a recent example, we had in Greece, in a refugee camp, there was a woman who was, I think she was taken to hospital. She was, she had COVID, and I do not know what the details of the story, but they brought her back to the camp and they placed her under quarantine. And the next morning she was found dead. For me, it is not clear whether she died because there was not enough, where she died from the virus, in which case, why she was clearly in a very acute stage and why they didn't leave her at hospital. But it's not clear whether she died from virus, what was she murdered, what happened with her. The point is the next day she was dead. And what followed this is that they started, and when I say they, I do not know who exactly, but my first thought it would be that they were men. They started setting the camp on fire. And this is a closed space where people cannot leave. And so they had burned like several, I don't know whether tents or like huts or houses. And we had these pictures of these flames in the camp and smoke. And this is a result of male violence and male frustration. And we know that we can expect this and we have to be ready for this. So... and, you know, I can list many other details, like if we go to the global south and the democratic collapse or monopolization of power by dictators and how they use the situation, which is also a category of male violence. All of those things are, of course, expected.
I've been interested in how this whole situation will impact women in the sex trade. Here in the West, for example, sex work lobby groups have expressed concern about lack of work. I don't know if that's come to fruition globally. It probably has to a certain extent in America and Canada. But do you know, or can you speak to how this pandemic and the lockdowns and social distancing have impacted women in prostitution?
Yes. The women, on the one hand, lost their whatever financial security that they had in whatever shape or form that this system provided to them. And this is the point where we not agree, but intersect with the sex work organizations when they claim that there is no protection for these women, there is no compensation for these women. And it's true that, of course, there would be some men who do not wish to go to brothels. I mean, brothels were shut down in the places, in countries like Germany or Switzerland. It just completely closed them. But of course, we know that brothels are not only those that are, you know, with the big sign brothels. It's happening in private flats. So there was a drop from what they call the clients in the frequency of visiting those places. This doesn't actually mean that they completely stopped doing it. We know that men in Italy were still arrested in the middle of the lockdown for being in the street trying to find women in prostitution. So it's not a total and complete elimination of demand from men. But there was definitely an impact from the economic perspective on the women's whatever limited access to finances through them being exploited in the system of prostitution. And this is where our agreement with the sex work organization ends. Because for them to solve this problem, we need to create something what they call the substitution of income. And this is only possible under condition when we recognize this as a job, which in our case would come from an entirely different perspective. And we argue that these women absolutely need protection. This is the first thing that needs to be done. And this is why a lot of our members have mobilized in different countries with different abolitionist organizations, demanding the governments to protect those women, to provide financial assistance, but not only financial assistance, also actual, real, durable solutions of how these women can exit the system of prostitution. And abolishing the system of prostitution and not recognizing it as any kind of occupation. But it also in terms of concrete examples of how women are impacted. I mean, we hear horrible stories. There was recently a story from France where women who were pimped, actually, I think from Russia or maybe some other parts of Eastern Europe, pimped at the age of 14 and being in a complete dependency on those pimps and now living in a forest, not having any idea where to seek for help because they never knew. I mean, those sex work organizations, they supposedly protect these women, but they never inform them about how to exit this industry, where to seek support, where to seek psychological support. And women were dying in the forest from COVID, not having any access to health services, but also living in fear. And again, similarly, it's a little bit similar to the situation with domestic violence, that, you know, we have two contradictory patterns. So on the one hand, we have cases of women, I can't name them, but there were some women who were very actively campaigning for legalization of prostitution. And at that point of the crisis, they turned around 180 degrees and came to the realization that this is not going to help them. And probably it is based on their understanding that when they turn to the sex work lobby, who doesn't really care about those women, we know this, and they didn't receive any support. So they actually turned to abolitionist organizations. And abolitionist organizations were trying, and they're still trying, to really find structural solutions and impose pressure on the government to support these women. On the other hand, we have cases of women who, I believe, probably for the reasons of real psychological dependency, and we know how women are manipulated by their exploiters, that they were seeking help from organizations such as ours, and now all of a sudden they're in the situation when they think, my pimp is the only person who can help me. And they disappeared from the radar. And we are very scared what is happening with these women. And we think that the risk for them now to accept any kind of conditions, they will be receiving men who have the symptoms. There is no way to verify it anyways. I mean, we know that men, they keep exploiting women and now they change it. They just say, you know, I'll have a blowjob instead of something else, or, you know, and he comes there wearing a mask, or he asks women to, you know, sanitize their mouth before they do the blowjob. Yes, so it's quite horrible. And what is also very concerning from this, again, we had recently a discussion with our members that those women were in these conditions before this crisis started. Of course, they are the most impacted, probably. But this is not to say that before the crisis there was some kind of safety or safety from you know, sexually transmitted diseases or unwanted pregnancy or, you know, beating and rape, which is what happens with these women all the time. It is quite tragic to see how the cause of these women and the pain of these women was instrumentalized by the sex work lobby. So what you're saying, what is happening in, I don't know, in Canada or United States, it's also happening in Europe. They were very fast to take, you know, to jump on this wave of public sympathy towards the most affected, and place their agenda as some kind of, here we are, we told you, if only you regularized it, then it would solve the problem, which of course is complete nonsense, because if this was the case, then all of the 40,000 women exploited in prostitution in Germany would be all receiving now benefits, but they don't, because they're not registered in this industry, and we know why they're not registered, because no woman wants to have a record on her CV that, you know, a couple of years ago she was working in a brothel, but otherwise she's a teacher or a nurse or something else. So yes, this is the situation.
And how has the porn industry benefited from all this?
Oh God, how did it? I mean, I've been listening about the porn industry for so many hours in the last several weeks, because the young women group from our network, the Radical Girls, they're running a campaign against pornography. So I attended the webinars, and we know, it's probably for anybody who would listen to it, they know that the Pornhub rolled out these premium services for men in Italy and Spain and somewhere else, France, I think. And we know that because more men are sitting at home now, and they can't go to a brothel. Those who are sex buyers, they would normally go in the street. They can't do it. So where are they going to turn to? They're going to turn to pornography. And of course, it's a huge industry, and they're not going to miss a chance. If they see that they can benefit from it, they will absolutely go for it. And so there was also an increase in consumption of pornography. But also, I think, like, from the perspective of the women, what we really fear is that a lot of the women will be pushed into pornography. Again, from undocumented women to domestic workers to women who were previously exploited in brothels, but now they will shift online. So I do not know what is the trajectory of all of this, but we definitely fear that there is both increase in consumption and in the push factors for the women to end up in in pornography online.
And I have been seeing that, you know, like Pornhub has been offering men free subscriptions and things like that. I just feel like it's so disgusting that these multi-billion-dollar companies, this industry is using this pandemic to kind of appear altruistic.
Yes, well, but this is what they've been doing for a while. I mean, they do the same with environmental issues and with feminism. I think there is absolutely, you know, it's an industry that is built on exploitation, it's built on lies, it's built on violence, and they, as such, it has no business principles apart from profit making. So for me, I don't expect, look, anything that will happen in the world from which they can benefit, they will use this opportunity. And from how skillfully they exploited even the feminist movement or the liberal feminist movement, and the whole, I mean, liberal ideology, and the environmental movement, and the movement for, you know, the the left movement, generally speaking, which you would expect they would be concerned with the issues of exploitation of women and prostitution and pornography. It's, I think, completely reasonable and natural for this industry and natural for us to expect that they would be the first one to find a way to benefit from this crisis. So, yeah, it's unsurprising.
So the reality of sex differences is important here. You discussed this in your article as well, of course. Men are more likely to die from COVID or complications from COVID-19, but there are also other issues facing women in particular. You know, surrogates are at a higher risk, for example. I wonder if the realities of this pandemic with relation to the realities of sex differences kind of throws a wrench into these recent popular ideas around gender identity.
Well, you would hope so, right? And that it's so obvious that I would expect that it would be like a wake-up call for a lot of people. That, I mean, you go only so far in denying the reality of human beings. I don't think that for those people who are the most vocal advocates for this ideology, that the gender identity ideology, I don't think for them it was a wake-up call. I think that for some people at the front line who are dealing with the emergency, it was, we're no longer in the position, we don't have the luxury to entertain this narcissistic obsession with our identities, but we rather need to deal with people dying, and whether you're male or a female can make a difference in this. So I think that it's definitely, I see it as an opportunity to have a priority fixed. Whether we will use it as a society or at political level, this opportunity, it's a question for me. I do not know. But yes, it brought to light, it clarified that sex is not a social construct. It impacts pretty much important aspects of our life, like the fact that whether you're going to stay alive or not. I mean, this is not a joke.
Yeah, of course. I mean, did you experience backlash around this article in general, but also specifically with relation to that issue, or, you know, any other issues, or was it mostly a positive response?
Well, from a lot of feminist movement, it was a positive response. I think that we don't generally experience backlash in the sense that, because we're not a single issue organization. We work what we would like to think about as intersectionality, the proper one. You know, once upon a time there was such thing, apparently. Mm-hmm. So we don't. For us, this is like one of the issues and one of the aspects of, let's say, our analytical framework. Yeah, of course, sex differences are important, not only from the perspective of biology or, you know, motherhood or surrogacy that you mentioned, but the fact that sex as a category is the ground for discrimination in the fundamental law of the European Union. We work with the law. And we're not going to give up on those laws that women were fighting for a long time. But this is not a single aspect. So we also deal with this migration status, with ethnic status, with, you know, women in poverty in refugee camps and so on. So we don't generally receive a backlash on this subject. But I wouldn't say that we also have, like, you know, a conversation, an open discussion about this, because as most political elite and institutions, they have been, I should say, I don't know if hijacked is the right word, but influenced, yes, and lobbied for a long time and without much awareness on behalf of the feminist movement or general public. And I think they would continue, they would prefer to continue working in the same way. They would just prefer kind of ignore somebody like us, who maybe is very opinionated, but strictly speaking, we don't have so much political power. So I think this is how they would prefer to deal with us at this point. But I mean, they would need to know that we're not going to disappear anywhere. And we'll continue working on our priorities, and the sex-based rights of women will remain on our agenda as they should be according to the law.
I wonder if finally you could offer some, I don't know, guidance, I suppose, to people, women, feminists, who want to, I mean, have like a global perspective on this whole thing, but sort of contribute in some way, in some sort of concrete solution-oriented way, to support, you know, the most marginalized people, you know, the women who are suffering particularly during this time.
Yeah, this is, well, under this current restrictive measures of lockdown, I think that not much can be done in practical way, because we're literally not allowed to leave the house. And because my first immediate advice to anyone would be to go and meet these women. I mean, it's not about doing feminist theory, it's about actually making friends with those women and understanding the reality and having a cup of tea with them and listening to their stories and understanding that a lot of the women, unless they went through some gender study department, they would be afraid of the word feminism, for example. It's just about building these human connections with women across our differences, across our racial, ethnic, religious differences, linguistic differences. And this is what we experience in our network. This is how we work. Like, we're very, very diverse. We have women from all over the world. And when we come together, we work with each other and we speak with each other as women, as first of all. So like these spaces and conversations that women have, that women can have, is one thing that I think is very important to do if we want to help those women, even though I don't like helping those women. But, you know, taking, then it would create also this relationship of equality between us and those women. And it will not be anymore us versus, or not versus, but us and them. But right now, in this situation, I'm perfectly aware this is not possible. So maybe turning into, you know, different women and feminists are discussing different issues and strategizing online and reading feminist literature. And maybe we could turn our attention to some of the, you know, fact-checking and understanding of the reality of the women, like the women who don't have regular legal status. Like, you know, there is a big gap generally between women who are working on some single issues, even in the abolitionist movement, you know, and those women who are dealing with resolving their very immediate, very pressing problems of survival, because they know they will be thrown out of the country. And this gap needs to be bridged. And in my experience, and I may be wrong, but I base it on experience of the work in our network, the way to bridge this gap is, you know, it's like egalitarian exchange. Okay, you might be not interested in my issue because it's not of your personal concern, and you and I might be not interested in your issue because it's not my personal concern. But what if we try to be interested in each other's issues and show more solidarity to each other? You know, for a lot of women who deal with their legal status, you know, maybe the question of abortion is not like they won't go for abortion rally. because it's just not an immediate priority. But for somebody who is concerned with abortion rights, you know, they never thought about what it means to live without documents. And we can look at those aspects that we never looked at before, and we can use this opportunity. It's just an advice from practical perspective of working in a very multi-ethnic organization where we're forced every day to listen to the stories that wouldn't ordinarily, you know, I wouldn't go online and search for those stories. And then you listen to them and you listen to what's happening in women, with women in Yemen and in Sudan and in or Latin America or Lebanon. And you think like, oh my God, I mean, I didn't think about it. And I have to be thinking about it. And it has to be part of my feminist consciousness. And then it changes some things in the way we act and what becomes our priorities in political advocacy and what we are not prepared to compromise anymore because it's not our issue. You know, things become our issue. Like, it's yours, you're a woman, and I also identify with this because I'm also a woman.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for your article, and thank you again for taking the time to talk with me about all this today. I'm so glad to bring this perspective to the Feminist Current audience.
Thank you for inviting me, and on behalf of the European Network of Migrant Women, thank you.
You just heard an interview with Anna Zobnina. You can find her article and learn more about the European Network of Migrant Women at migrantwomennetwork.org. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. We are solely listener-funded. We don't take ads. We don't have government or corporate funding. We're wholly dependent on donations, so please help us out. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.